Hi friends, welcome to Life in Higher Ed. I am Herminio Perez.
And I'm Denise Nelson Nash. Life in Higher Ed is not just a podcast, it's a community of learners and change makers.
Our goal is to be of service and to inspire and support you in your journey. So, welcome to Life in Higher Ed.
Hello, friends, and welcome to today's episode of Life in Higher Ed. We are delighted to begin our series of conversations with college and university presidents, starting with Dr. Aisha Francis, President and CEO of Benjamin Franklin Cummings Institute of Technology. Dr. Francis's path to the presidency and her vision for her institution is emblematic of the most effective of college presidents. Welcome, Dr. Francis.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
No, thank you so much, Dr. Francis. And we are so pleased to have you with us today. After speaking with you, we were inspired to do a series of episodes this season on college presidency, speaking with presidents from three different types of institutions. And we are so pleased to begin with you and talk about all the remarkable achievements you have set in motion in just over 2 years. Then let's start with you telling us about your path to the presidency and a brief profile of Benjamin Franklin Cummings Institute of Technology.
Well, first of all, I again commend you all for making this space to have conversations about various aspects of higher education and the field. So thank you for creating this podcast and for the invitation. So I am really, it's a privilege to be the president and CEO of Franklin Cummings Tech. We are a technical and trade college, and our mission is to deliver transformative technical and trade education that leads to economic advancement. Our history dates back to Benjamin Franklin, one of the nation's founders, who left funds to the city of Boston for the purpose of helping people who wanted to seek out a trade pay for the apprenticeship, because apprenticeships were, that was something that was only for people who could pay for it. And he wanted to make sure that folks had an opportunity that he had to become a printer. And he also realized that it wasn't only his trade that was the foundation of his success. It was also the fact that he was a business owner. So the secondary purpose of the funds he left to the city of Boston were to help folks who already had a trade start a business. So we have this legacy of trade education and entrepreneurship that we have been really carrying forward from 1790 until today. And so I think that that history is really interesting and important. And it's something that we think about even now as we look at the program mix that we offer. And my journey to the presidency, I think, was unconventional in some ways and in other ways not. I am an academic. I earned my PhD in English literature. Attended Fisk University. I'm an HBCU graduate, and then went from there to Vanderbilt University, taught for a while, and then decided during the time that I was completing my dissertation that the divide between, town and gown, as we hear it, between theory and praxis, was one that I was really more interested in exploring than the confines of the traditional Research One Academy would really allow. And so I took a break from the academy, what was intended to be a short break from the kind of pursuit of tenure track roles, and became a professional fundraiser. So I was a grant writer, and that's what brought me to Boston. And from there, I honed my career in nonprofit leadership and nonprofit management, really through the lens of resource development. And in a short story, that's what led me to the presidency. So at this college, I've been here 5 years at Franklin Cummings Tech. I started as chief of staff and ascended to the presidency, as you mentioned, at Herminio 2 years ago.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing your path with us. And resource development and economic advancement are two things we want to talk more about later on in our conversation. But I believe we need a little bit of grounding. Now, people know that there are presidents of institutions. But I'm not sure everybody knows what a president does. So if you could just start off with some foundational about describing the role of a president of an institution.
Absolutely. So the presidency is a really foundational leadership role. You set the vision for the college. You're responsible for the execution of strategy and also for making sure that the day-to-day operations are managed through your leadership team. It is also your job to make sure that the college is fiscally sound. No money, no mission, as they say. And so that mix of whatever the resource mix is that keeps a particular college afloat should be something that a president has well in hand, as well as a kind of concept for how to grow the resources at the institution. It doesn't really matter how well endowed an institution is. Every institution has places of need and, you know, where they can use additional resources. So, you know, most people have a general sense that the presidency is really 50% fundraising at least. And I would agree with that. A lot of relationship development. And then the other piece, which is, you know, equally important, is governance and board management. So the president really serves at the pleasure of the board. And so that dynamic and managing that dynamic is of utmost importance for any presidential leader.
Thank you.
No, thank you so much. And our listeners can't see you, but we want to celebrate you as the first female president of Benjamin Franklin Cummings Institute of Technology. And being recognized by the Boston Business Journal in 2021 as among the 40 under 40 leaders to watch. And as a woman of color, you are part of the 14% of Black females president. What are some of the things you navigated being the first in your role?
Interesting. You know, I don't necessarily think about the first things that I've had to navigate, but I am going to go back and make just one adjustment. So the Boston 40 Under 40 was a recognition I received in 2011. I'm no longer under 40. Oh. So, but I do have a great.
But we all want to think that.
A great relationship with the BBJ, with the there certainly been, for me, this has been a season of accolades and recognition. So I do acknowledge that. And I don't, you know, that hasn't been anything that I have chased. I think what people recognize is that, the story of the institution and the people who we serve. So we are a minority serving institution being led, in a really, historic moment of people paying attention to the need for technical and trade education, you know, with the Infrastructure Act and a lot of the funds coming out of ARPA have been really focused on making this clean energy transition. And here we are, Clean Energy College, where most of the students identify as men of color. We welcome everyone, but that the reality is that we're a minority serving institution where 70% of our students are Black and Brown men. So I think, you know, to lead this college at this moment from my subject position is something that folks have taken notice of. And so, you know, that has something to do with the attention that we've received. But our outcomes and telling the story of our outcomes has been really something that I focused on. So I think that doing your work, whatever the work is, with the kind of a head down focus, that's certainly one approach, but it doesn't necessarily serve us well when we're in a moment where folks are really I think questioning the value of post-secondary education. So for me, it's been really important to demonstrate and tell wherever I go, listen, we have best-in-class graduation rates, amazing job placement rates, 85% full-time in-field job placement rates. Our earnings are really, I think, tremendous, considering the backgrounds that our students are coming from. Most of them are first-generation college students. More than half are immigrants or children of immigrants. And so for me, I've taken great pleasure and pride in telling this story. And these are stats that this college has had for a decade. So it's the people, it's the staff, it's the faculty and the students themselves and their resilience that create these outcomes. And it's my job to amplify that. And so I think, you know, making sure that people know that there's good stories to be told is really important. And if anything, you know, I hope that that's the hallmark of my presidency. And, you know, I think that's one of the most important parts of my job.
No, thank you. Thank you so much. And Denise, if you allow me to, because you just mentioned, Dr. Francis, something that is really, really important to me and in my field of healthcare. And the reality is that we are lacking representation, particularly when it comes to Black males in healthcare. We are lacking a lot of that. And my question to you is, what we should do to empower these Black kids and men to go into different professions and to embrace that? And also, what institutions should do in order to be more, to embrace them?
Sure. Well, you know, those are two interconnected, but also distinct questions. And I think I'll start by saying that it's the exposure, right? So even this podcast, right, is an opportunity. It's a tool for us to share different avenues of professional development. What are the career paths of people of all backgrounds tend to replicate what they see. And if you've never heard of healthcare management or a master's of public health, it's hard to aspire to something that you don't really understand. And so I think each of us at the institutions that we lead have to have a community focused approach of some sort. You know, everyone, every institution can't take on everything, but we should be very purposeful in what aspects of our programming we're carrying out with the perspective of broadening the field and broadening exposure, career exploration opportunities. And for us, our early college programming, which we've run since 2006 or seven, and we did that specifically as a way to start exposing folks to tech and trade education earlier in the pipeline. And then in terms of what do we do, particularly for Black and brown men, how do we build more inclusive environments? You know, I think in a nutshell, it's hard to articulate, but when you feel it, you know it's there. And I think that is building inclusive environments that center belonging and authenticity. And to me, the easiest way to do that, not that it's necessarily easy, but I don't think it's as hard as people make it seem, is that your faculty and staff need to reflect the population that you serve. And even if you're building towards that, right, there's got to be some place, whether it's a center, whether it's the you know, the wellness center, whether it's the gym, the pool room, there's got to be some place where people can go and sort of put down the masking and code switching and all of those things and just relax and be themselves and just be, right? And I think those are elements that make a campus environment welcoming for people from backgrounds that have been marginalized. And to have a welcoming and inclusive campus, it's something you can't fake that. You know, people can see right through the even if it's the, you know, the bells and the whistles, we're in a campus that has it's at the end of its life. And so we are building a new one. But despite that, it's the warmth that people can feel, right? And the excitement about seeing the individual, knowing their names, making sure we have an understanding of any kind of support that people need. And all of these things go into creating an inclusive and supportive environment that's based on authenticity.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for that.
Yeah. So you both have touched on something that I want to explore a little bit further, and that's the issues of inequities and expectations and sort of progress of where we are today. Because very often for our young people who are entering into post-secondary education, it's not always obvious what has gone on before them to get them to this place today where they can enter into these spaces. And so in your inauguration address, you talked about your great aunt Georgia, who was the superintendent of industrial education of the Negro School Division of Davidson County Schools. I was very touched by that when I watched your inauguration. And from your account, she was truly inspiring. And so what do you see as changes in education since your Aunt Georgia's time and today, and what progress is still needed?
Certainly. Yes, the family story of Aunt Georgia is one that was carried with me. So to be able to find, you know, the actual some of her actual reports from the 30s and 40s was amazing. You know, one thing that is clear is that we have opened up educational access, right? Are we where we need to be? No. But compared to, you know, 100 years ago, you know, there is certainly a robust system of public education. You know, schools are resegregated. Public schools are resegregated. And I think one of the challenges we have is to really push the limits of what it means to deliver access for all. I think that property tax-based systems of funding public education are troublesome and problematic. And as long as we have this legacy of redlining and, you know, really racism baked into our systems, if we continue to fund public education based on these legacies, you know, you're going to continue to get what you're going to get, right? So I do think that we need to trouble these notions through policy, which takes a long time. Meanwhile, our kids are in school, right? So to the extent that we can invest in the education systems that exist, and I mean by invest, I mean locally, spending time. My children are in public schools, in Boston public schools, you know, spending time in their school, volunteering, doing the things that it takes to have an active school committee. I think that's important work. And it's work that not everyone has the ability to do because some people are working multiple jobs. And so I think of that, you know, how can I stand in the gap for other people, right? For other parents? How can my husband and I do this for someone who literally doesn't have enough time in the day, but they are interested? So those are things that I think about. And, you know, when I look at these records at Aunt Georgia, mentioned a lot of the work that she was doing was community service. It was support. It was, you know, making sure that if people needed clothes if their food insecurity or lack of having proper resources were stopping them from attending school, her job was to figure out how to stand in that gap. And I think that we're still in that place today. In a lot of ways. And I do think that that's too bad. On the other hand, I know when you look at, you know, college attainment and, you know, high school attainment, you know, we have made strides, but we're not done yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for that. And just one follow-up question. If you could change just one thing in your institution today to address some of those gaps, what would it be?
Oh, we would have a really robust endowment so that we could meet the full financial need for every single student. if I had could snap my fingers and have that be done, that is something that would make a huge difference. About 80% of our students are working. They're working far more hours than studies show they should in order to have successful outcomes in college. And they're working out of economic necessity. And I would have a fund that would help alleviate that burden so that they could focus more of their short time that they're with us, since we're a sub-bachelor's degree institution, you know, focus on college and still have their needs met at home.
Thank you for that. And I know that throughout this conversation, you mentioned about the responsibilities and the role that we have to the student population that we are serving, to the community that we are representing to. But also you mentioned about the environment. And I would like to hear from you, what is the role of a president in contributing to the protection of the environment?
Sure. So, I mentioned that we're a clean tech college. And what I mean by that is that for a long time now, one of our learning outcomes for every major has been to connect the classroom learning to sustainability. We have one planet, and without that, there is no us. And so I think it's a very, close and ever-present connection that we're making. And so our job as an institution is to make sure that there are enough electricians, right? So, electrification is one of the important paths of the clean energy transition. We educate folks in HVAC and refrigeration, in clean manufacturing and renewable energy, even IT. A lot of every company, even renewable energy companies, need really good networking and system support and great cybersecurity talent. So, all of our programs have a through line into sustainability and the clean economy. And it's my job to really help make the technical careers that are essential for the clean energy transition much more accessible. And we want, through environmental justice, a lot of the communities that bear the biggest burdens of pollution and the negative effects of the way we've treated our environment are communities that where there are more people of color and low income, and where people are just as impacted. And so for our college to be situated and purposely serving those same communities, while giving them an opportunity to be part of these new economy jobs, the green economy jobs, I think that is an important role of my presidency and of the college itself.
Yes. Thank you. And as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking about, Arminio and I come from two different institutions. I'm at a small liberal arts college, and Arminio's situation is, in a larger environment. But when we're talking about workforce development, and we're talking about a technical college education, and we're talking about how it opens up possibilities to so many individuals, I'm just wondering what you see that those of us in post-secondary education can do to improve the narrative around the value of a technical education.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for that question. I think one of the things, all we have to do is look at reality. The reality is that more than half of people of color who receive a college degree, that pathway comes through two-year colleges. Right. It is a important aspect of our educational ecosystem to have, I think, a way. And anytime there's an opportunity to mention college, to talk about the varieties of colleges that exist, that there aren't these. I think we focus a lot on hierarchies, and we sometimes replicate the sense that colleges college unless you're going away, even though the reality is most people who attend college do not leave their home to do it. They really don't. But that's the image that we see, you know, in movies and films and books, is this bucolic liberal arts campus, maybe up here in New England, and there are many forms of college education. And so I think one of the things that we have to do is to validate and really cheer on people's choices and the fact that they have choices. So I think that's one important thing that we can do. And is, you know, wherever we are proximate to people who are having conversations about post-secondary education, is to always, you know, make sure we're talking about the continuum of, you know, early college opportunities, two-year college opportunities, and, you know, graduate school as well, and all of the things that are in between.
Dr. Francis, this conversation is very insightful, and I can hear in your voice the passion and commitment that you have for your institution and for everything that you are doing. Unfortunately, our conversation is going to an end at some point, even though that we would like to continue talking to you. And don't be surprised that we're going to invite you again for a second part of this conversation. But I have a final question for you. And what is your legacy in the making?
Wow. So it's this push to really think about legacy. You know, one of the things that I talk to my children about, who are, my son is 9, my daughter is 8, is this sense of integrity, right? What is it that you do? Who are you when nobody's looking? And I hope that the sense of integrity beyond reproach is part of my legacy. And you know, what does it look like to lead in an authentic way, whether you're the president of an institution or you're not? You know, a role is temporary. This title is temporary. It isn't who I am. I am who I am, and I happen to be leading in an authentic way from this perch of the presidency. It's a privilege, but it is not permanent, and I don't own it. I'm renting it. And so I want to steward this role. I want to be a good steward of this institution. And beyond that, in a broader sense, you know, my legacy is the investment in my children and in my community.
Thank you so much for that, Denise.
Yeah, that was beautiful. just adding my thanks for this wide-ranging conversation that's ending all too soon. And Erminio's right. We know where to find you now, Dr. Francis. We're going to be inviting you back.
Happy to do it. And so, I'm excited about your theme, the season theme of, you know, hearing from the voices of presidents of different types of institutions. Thank you for what you do.
Thank you. Well, we celebrate you, as we said earlier. And we also have a tradition in Life in Higher Ed to end with the words of a thought leader. And we believe this episode's chosen thought leader is particularly appropriate given our conversation today. Benjamin Franklin, who is drafter and signer of the United States Declaration of Independence. And we have to get the U.S. in there because we have listeners from 15 different countries. So we want to just frame that for them. He was also our first Postmaster General, author, scientist, inventor, diplomat, and statesman. And Benjamin Franklin is quoted as saying, "An education is the investment with the greatest returns." And I believe our conversation certainly has demonstrated that through all that you are doing, through the achievements of your students and graduates that you have noted, and all of those who have gone before you, before us, who have paved the way and set this foundation for those of us who have been able to go through the door of education to have an impact in our communities.
And Denise, that's a perfect quote to wrap up our discussion. And thank you, Dr. Francis, for joining us and acquainting us with the Institute and your approach to leadership as president and CEO.
My pleasure.
Yes. So thank you. This was a fantastic conversation and so helpful in gaining a better understanding of the role of the presidency, and how we can think about supporting the executive leadership of our institutions in advancing their goals and being mission driven. Because as the old saying goes, it takes a village, and we are all part of supporting the aspirations and achievements of those within our community.
And I agree with you, Denise. And to our listeners, please do not forget to subscribe to our podcast. We are on Apple Podcasts, we are on Spotify, we are on Google Podcasts and other podcast platforms. And thank you for joining us for this episode. And we look forward to joining us next time when we explore another aspect of life in higher ed. Thank you so much, and bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.